It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, horse dentistry. Yes, horse dentistry has come a long way over thousands of years. Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine joins us to talk about that story and more from the world of science. First, the international community got a surprise a few months ago over what was supposed to be an uneventful vote on breastfeeding. It all happened at a meeting of the World Health Assembly over a resolution supporting breastfeeding as the healthiest option for children. New reporting from the New York Times shows an American effort to water down the measure and hardline tactics to get other countries to drop the issue. Andrew Jacobs is a reporter with the Health and Science Desk for the New York Times. He broke the story over the weekend, and he joins us now. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about what this resolution was trying to do.
It was pretty pro forma. It's essentially calling on countries around the world to promote breastfeeding and also to limit the marketing or sort of inappropriate marketing of infant formula and other products aimed at young children. And the U.S. initially was trying to block that resolution entirely, and then they used threats later on to sort of try to change it.
Yeah, talk about the pressure put on countries like Ecuador that were looking to sponsor this measure.
Ecuador was the initial sponsor for the resolution, and the U.S., according to diplomats I spoke to, threatened the country with trade sanctions and also withdrawal of some military aid, and they quickly folded. Other countries that were had plans to introduce it were also threatened and backed away. In the end, it was Russia, a country not necessarily known for promoting public health matters, stepped forward and introduced the resolution.
And this is all going on at the World Health Assembly in Geneva, Switzerland. Set the scene for us. What is this organization?
They are the decision-making body for the World Health Organization, and so they meet every 2 years, and it's normally a fairly placid kind of meeting where they agree on things that have been discussed prior to the meeting. And in fact, this resolution had been hammered out over four previous meetings in May, so everyone was a bit surprised when the U.S. Tried to quash it, and it led to a lot of sort of bureaucratic maneuvering. 2 days of meetings, the U.S. ended up introducing its own resolution, a competing resolution against the one Russia introduced, and that took two more days to sort of reconcile the two versions, and apparently unprecedented at this meeting.
What do we know about why the American delegation wanted to stop or limit this resolution on the health benefits of breastfeeding?
Well, what they claim publicly is that they felt this resolution stigmatizes women who can't breastfeed for medical reasons, or perhaps they're working mothers and they need to rely on infant formula. They were just trying to sort of help women who need to use breast milk substitutes and things like infant formula. Advocates say they were just simply doing the bidding of the infant formula industry. That seems to be what's going on.
And when you talk about the original resolution, talking about how these breast milk replacement formulas are marketed, these formula products should be banned in countries, but rather, as I understand it, they shouldn't be marketed as somehow being superior to breast milk. Is that right?
Exactly. There are a lot of hospitals, especially in the developing world, will give out samples of breast of infant formula, or they might encourage nurses might encourage women to use infant formula, and there's a sort of the marketing also tells a lot of women that this is superior to breast milk, that somehow it's Western, it's modern, it's better, and so they for many decades now there's been efforts to sort of downplay that and restrict the marketing, the inappropriate marketing of breast milk substitutes. So, yeah, that was what's going on.
And talk about the industry. I think it was in your piece you talked about there's a changing market for formula, less so in developed nations like the United States.
Yeah, in much of the developed world, U.S., Europe, sales in formula are flat. They have been flat for years. Most of the growth, about 4% a year, is in the developing world where you have newly emerging middle class, women going to work for the first time. And they see that as a potential growth market.
Talking to Andrew Jacobs, reporter with the Health and Science Desk for the New York Times, talking about an effort by the U.S. delegation at the World Health Assembly earlier this year to stop and then to water down a resolution on the health benefits of breastfeeding. Andrew, since your story came out, the president himself tweeted, and I'm quoting the tweet here, "The failing NY Times fake news story today about breastfeeding must be called out. The U.S. strongly supports breastfeeding, but we don't believe women should be denied access to formula. Many women need this option because of malnutrition and poverty." So that's the president's response to your reporting.
Well, that's it's interesting. First of all, no one's called for the banning of these products or even restricting the sales. It's all about the marketing and promotion of these products. Second of all, it's just sort of contradictory that if women are impoverished, I'm not sure how they're going to be able to afford expensive Swiss or U.S.-made infant formula. So I think that sort of missed the mark.
Have industry advocates, the companies who make these formula products that market them around the world, have they responded to this story since it came out?
Abbott, which is one of the biggest U.S. makers, did not want to comment. Nestle said that they were not behind these threats. And they said they do support efforts to encourage and protect breastfeeding.
We have these American efforts. So what ended up passing? What is in place now with the World Health Organization when it comes to their recommendations on how countries handle the health benefits of breastfeeding?
In the end, the U.S. effort was largely unsuccessful. The wording was sort of tinkered with to remove some of the language. Especially calling the WHO to sort of monitor and encourage some of these programs. In the end, they just inserted a few words here and there, which made a lot of people unhappy. But I think for the most part, the language, which has been in place for years now, sort of stands as is.
And as far as the science goes, it seems, I haven't studied it closely, it seems like this is pretty settled that when there's an option between breastfeeding and formula, breastfeeding is generally the healthier option, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's decades of studies now that show that it's far superior, both for the mother's health and the child's health, all kinds of immunological advantages and other kinds of preventing diseases in children, and also IQ. There's good research showing that children who are breastfed have higher IQs than children who are not breastfed, and there's research showing that if more people breastfed, there would be 800,000 fewer deaths a year among children. So it's pretty solid. There's very little disagreement in the research community on this.
As a health reporter, do you find yourself having to cover diplomatic squabbles like this, or is this kind of a rare case?
This is a rare case. This diplomats that I spoke to who were involved in this issue said they were really surprised. There has been tension for years, whether it's Democratic or Republican administrations, over these recommendations, because the U.S. feels in general that that some of these advocates are a bit radical in the way they're pushing this language. But what I was told is no one's ever resorted to threats. It's always sort of negotiated out beforehand, and there's, you know, a happy agreement in the end. It's really the first time anyone can remember there was a threat to a country to withdraw military aid and to impose trade sanctions.
We'll leave it there for now. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Andrew Jacobs of the New York Times talking to us about U.S. opposition to a breastfeeding resolution before the World Health Assembly earlier this year. He broke that story in a piece that came out over the weekend. Right now, we look at some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. This month, we'll check out some feet built for tree climbing, early adventures in dental care for horses, and the search for the earliest dogs in the new world. Gemma Tarlak is the senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She wrote about these topics for her Dead Things blog. Gemma, good to have you back with us.
Hello, and happy science to you, my friend.
And to you. Let's climb some trees, first of all, Gemma. Some new evidence about one of our distant, very ancient, pre-ancient relatives and their tree-climbing structure. Talk about the story.
Yeah, this is really interesting because this fossil is unique in the fossil record of hominins, which are all the apes that are more closely related to humans, including humans, than to other apes. So we're talking about, you may recall, Homo naledi. We've talked about that hominin and, of course, our Neanderthal and Denisovan brothers and sisters. And all these hominins, including Australopithecus afarensis, that is the same species that Lucy is. And the Afarensis species has been of particular interest for a long time because people have focused on that species perhaps being the first fully bipedal hominin, the first hominin who climbed down from the trees and was living on the ground, walking around, running around. So that gets us to this new fossil. It was actually found in 2002, but it took them this long to prep it because it was kind of embedded in this rock that made it really difficult to study. But they were finally able to study it, get the rock away, and just study the fossil. It is so special because it is a fossil of a juvenile. They think the individual was about 3 years old when it passed away. And we don't have any other juvenile feet from this species in the fossil record at all. So for that reason alone, it's exciting. But it's also the oldest hominin foot that we have in the fossil record that preserves some key parts of the foot that tell us a lot about how the individual lived.
And Gemma, it's easy to take our feet for granted, even in the modern day. What can we learn from looking at this, millions of years old foot?
Yeah, it's 3.32 million years old, and we can learn from the back of the foot, which is preserved in this specimen, which is great. We don't have it anywhere else in the fossil record from this age. It shows that the individual could walk bipedally, and they could tell that by the way the joints aligned, the foot to the ankle. So that's great. We know that this individual was walking around bipedally, but it also retained really unique characteristics that we don't see in adult members of the same species. Things like, for example, the shape of its heel was not really evolved for walking. It was a little more ape-like. And the big toe appeared to have a lot of flexibility preserved so that the big toe could have been a grasping big toe. And that's really important because when you think about tree climbing, to do tree climbing really efficiently, you got to get the toes involved. I don't know if you watch American Ninja Warrior. I do. True confession. I love it. But, you know, you see those guys climbing around using a lot of upper body strength. But when it comes down to it, humans, modern humans, have really lost all the flexibility and graspiness in our big toes, but it appears that this child, this juvenile, still retained a graspy big toe. And what the researchers concluded was it seems that juveniles of this species retained the ability to walk or climb very efficiently in the trees, but they could still walk bipedally. And we don't see that anywhere else in the fossil record, that kind of transitional, good at climbing when you're young, good at walking when you're an adult. So it's an exciting and unique fossil.
Right. So this is part of this mystery of at some point our ancestors were arboreal. They lived a lot of the time in trees. At some point they came down and walked around on the savannas and whatnot. And this might be part of how that happened, a transitional stage where when we're younger, yeah, we can scramble in the trees, but as we're older, we're getting better at walking around.
Exactly, and this is, I want to stress that this part is speculation, but there are a lot of researchers who think that the earlier hominins may have climbed up into the trees for safety. You know, if you're about 3.5 feet tall, 4 feet tall, and you've got a bunch of lions coming at you, yeah, it's really great to be able to climb a tree for safety. But later, as they became adults, they needed to go forage to find food to walk long distances. So it would make a lot of sense that the younger members of the species would still be able to climb up a tree very efficiently, perhaps for safety, perhaps to sleep. But as they got older and had to forage and had to cover greater distances on the ground, then they were more efficient walkers.
Now, as a modern-day human, Gemma, I might think, okay, why can't I have both? Why can't I have a foot that's great for walking and that's great for climbing trees? And this is a kind of a sidebar here. This is one of the trade-offs we see in natural selection.
Yes, you can't have it all.
There are but I want it all.
Like, I know, right? So there are things like, you know, if you have a really good grabby toe and your big toe can grab things, makes you an efficient climber, that skeletal structure, the way that the muscles and the ligaments and the bones and everything line up, means that you are not going to be running marathons anytime soon. You're just not going to be an efficient walker because, you know, you can't have it all. So it's always an evolutionary trade-off. And if this juvenile retained tree climbing abilities in, you know, when it was young, that tells us that there had to be a really good reason, evolutionary speaking. There had to be some advantage that particular setup gave that species. So it's super exciting. This is the only juvenile foot they have from Australopithecus afarensis. So, you know, we can't be 100% sure that this is how all of the juvenile feet were, but it is really exciting. And again, we've never seen anything like this in the fossil record.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine about some of the coolest stories from the world of science. Gemma, moving on from early humans to early humans' best friends, dogs. And another mystery here, the question of when and how dogs came to the New World and what happened to them. And we have some new information. What do we know?
Yeah, well, to back up just a bit, there's been a divide among researchers who try to figure out when and where dogs were domesticated. There's one camp that says dogs were domesticated in Eurasia, and then when people came across Beringia, the land bridge that's now submerged between Siberia and Alaska, when it was above sea and they came across on Beringia, they brought their Eurasian dogs with them. That's one camp. The other camp says, no, when people came over into the Americas and came into the Americas, spread throughout, they encountered a local American wolf population, and those were the animals that were domesticated to become the first American dogs. For a long time, it's been really hard to get an answer to figure out which camp was right, and that's because a lot of times, pretty much all the time until the last couple of years, researchers could only study DNA from modern dogs. And when you look at DNA from any modern dog, I don't care if it's a Chihuahua or a Great Dane, anything in between, what you're going to see is genes that are the result of a lot of intentional breeding over centuries and even millennia, but you're also going to see a lot of interbreeding. Dogs were domesticated, you know, they may have hooked up once or twice with a coyote, with a wolf, whatever, so it's really hard to read their genetic history because there's so much going on. Now, however, they're able to extract and sequence DNA from ancient dogs. Some of the dogs in this study, 10,000 years old, they're able to look at their DNA and see what their DNA was like before, you know, we started all this intentional breeding for poofy ears and fluffy coats and whatnot. So they're able to get a much, much more accurate picture of what ancient dogs looked like. And that's when they found that looking at the ancient American dogs, they were very, very close genetically to each other. Even ancient American dogs sampled from all over the continents, very closely related to each other, which tells us that they probably had a single common ancestral population. They were able to compare that information to other ancient dogs all around the world, and they found that the ancient dogs of the Americas were very closely related to Siberian dogs. So that tells them that there is no evidence that ancient American dogs were actually domesticated American wolves. Everything they saw tells them that the ancient dogs came over into the Americas with people who were living in Siberia and Beringia.
And then kind of a sad end to that story, those dogs, the original or earliest dogs that were here, not really anything left of them now.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's unfortunate. They were able to identify, again, because they have all this ancient dog DNA now, they were able to identify three events about 1,000 years ago. A culture came over from Siberia called the Thule culture, and they brought dogs with them that wiped out some of the original American dogs. Then, of course, about 500 years ago, Europeans and their dogs started arriving in large numbers. And then also sled dogs imported during the gold rush in Alaska in the 19th century. They wiped out all of the remaining original American dogs. And they even, you know, they looked at, for example, Chihuahuas and Catahoulas. That's a dog from the southern United States that they're often touted as native dogs, you know, some of the descended from the first American dogs. They looked at those modern populations, and they couldn't find any detectable heritage from those very first American dogs.
I want to switch to another animal, Gemma. We promised some talk about horse dentistry. Talk a little bit about what we're learning. Horses were a big deal in some human cultures starting as early as 5,000, 6,000 years ago.
Yeah, we think they were domesticated about 5,000 years ago, most likely in what's now Kazakhstan and southern Russia. But, you know, one of the areas that has been so, that horses have been so important to for millennia is Mongolia. And they're still the major way of moving people and moving stuff across the steppe in Mongolia. And so researchers looked at all these different horse teeth from all these different periods in the past in Mongolia, and they were looking for signs that when horse dentistry arose, and they found a couple teeth that are, they're both about 3,150 years old. So this is way, way back. I mean, this is, you know, pretty close to when horses were first domesticated. That these particular two teeth definitely have signs of dentistry. And it's kind of cringe-inducing.
Yeah, if you don't like going to the dentist now, this is way, way worse.
Right? I was going to say, if you're listening to this and thinking, oh, I don't know about this, just start humming happy birthday to yourself. and I'll finish up real quick. But yeah, from everything they can tell, based on the microstriations in these teeth, they think someone took a sharpened stone tool and was sawing away at the tooth. Why would they do this? Well, for these particular two teeth, they were not growing in properly and likely caused the young horses a lot of pain and difficulty chewing. So it appears that the early horse dentists were trying to help the horses out. In neither case was it successful. But it does show that there was a lot of care and attention even more than 3,000 years ago to the health of the horse.
We'll leave it there for now, Gemma, and some Novocaine maybe next time at the dentist's office.
I think so.
Gemma, thanks
as always.
Yeah, that's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joined us for a monthly check-in on some of the latest scientific discoveries. You can find links to Gemma's blog post we've been talking about at WPR.org. She blogs at Dead Things. First, for some, organized religion has gotten a bad name because of things like sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, conflict over divisive social issues, and acts of terrorism and religious warfare. While surveys show that younger generations are drifting away from organized religion, our next guest says there are many things we encounter in day-to-day living that we may need religion to deal with. Stephen Asma is a professor of philosophy and founding fellow of the research group in Mind, Science, and Culture at Columbia College, Chicago. His new book is Why We Need Religion. Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, Stephen, I want to get a little bit about where you're coming from, because some people out there are listening now are people of faith and thinking, well, of course I need religion. Can you talk about where you're coming from as a philosophy professor and a bit of a skeptic yourself?
Yeah, I was raised religious and was a devout Christian, and then went away to college, and like a lot of people, sort of had a lapse in my faith, and I got a PhD in philosophy, and it seemed to me that I couldn't sort of commit to the religious ideas like I had before. They didn't seem as true, in the sense that they didn't seem like there was a proof for the claims of religion. And so this leads a lot of people, particularly there's a growing number of younger folks, the millennials, to mark themselves as nones, N-O-N-E-S, meaning they sort of reject traditional religious affiliation. They may be spiritual, or they may be, like myself, agnostic, but they no longer sort of subscribe to religion. And I looked around and I saw that the only people sort of talking about religion are either very devout believers or sort of the new atheists, who are extremely intense critics of religion, saying, you know, it's stupid, it's for stupid people, and it's ignorant. And I thought, you know, there's a huge middle ground that's missing here. All the people I know seem to be, you know, maybe we're somewhere on a continuum. We believe some things, we have questions, we have doubt, we have a mixture of belief and doubt. And so I wanted to write a book that was really about this large majority of us that are in the middle territory.
You focus a lot in the book on the function of religion, not so much as looking at claims to truth and whether things are right or wrong. And I want to quote here, you're talking about religion's main function, quote, is not a path to morality, nor can it substitute for a scientific understanding of nature. Its chief virtue is emotional management. Can you talk about religion and emotional management?
Yeah, I think I didn't quite appreciate this until I went and lived in the developing world. About 15 years ago, I lived in Cambodia. I've also lived in China and traveled a lot in Thailand, in Laos, and Vietnam. And I began to see that religion in these places is really about emotional management, a sort of therapy for our emotional lives. And I could see it clearly there because people are suffering greatly. You know, in Cambodia, you know, one out of every 10 people you see in downtown is missing a limb from, you know, a landmine accident. There's this tremendous suffering in the developing world. But I could see that there were places where science or medicine could not really help people with this suffering, but religion was extremely helpful in helping people keep their peace of mind, keep their optimism, keep hope, stay inspired, stay strong. So in the daily life of the average person, religion is extremely good at managing our emotions. And when I returned to the States, I began to see, oh, that's what it's doing here too. It's not really just the developing world situation, but the Christianity, Judaism, and Islam that we're more familiar with here is also doing the same thing.
You look at neuroscience and evolution and make the case that our brains are wired, maybe not for a particular religion or even a kind of religion, but our brains are emotionally wired to be receptive to spirituality and religious belief. Can you spell out how that works?
Yeah, I did some work starting about 10 years ago on emotional neuroscience, which is basically studying not so much how we think, but how we feel. And neuroscientists disagree a little bit about the number here, but there's anywhere between 4 and 7 basic emotions. It's stuff we would all recognize. We all have fear. We all have lust and love or care. People, you know, human beings and mammals generally have anger or rage. So there's this list of emotions, and these are in the deep old brain. This is part of being a mammal, and you see this in your dog, in rats and squirrels, in any kind of mammal. And this brain has been evolving for as long as 200 million years, whereas the rational part of our brain is relatively recent. That's the neocortex, and it's what gives us rationality, and probably it's where a lot of our executive functions and cognitive thinking reside. But that's very recent. And the argument I'm making in the book is that religion is one of the earliest forms of culture that evolved, and it's very good at helping us with this emotional brain. And how we feel is as important to our survival as how we think.
And we discount that, you write. We may think we're more rational than we really are, not realizing that the emotions, even when we're thinking rationally, the emotion is still there as a guide.
Right. I think we have a distorted picture of our own rationality. We think we're always being rational and that the emotions maybe get in the way and contaminate our sort of logical calculations. But really, it's quite the opposite. Most of us are operating through our emotions. The emotions evolved as an adaptive strategy for our social world. Like we have to deal with people in our family on a daily basis. I mean, let's look at today. You had to get up and deal with members of your family, the social hierarchy at work. There's dominance, there's subordination. You've got to figure out who are your allies, who are your enemies. And so our emotions are very good at helping us navigate in this form of social intelligence. Along comes the rational brain, and it's very good at describing the world and giving us things like science. So I'm a huge fan of science, and I believe it's the proper way to describe and understand nature. But really, how many scientific problems did you solve this morning or today? Not too many. Same with me. But I've had to solve many social problems or challenges, and the emotions are very good at helping us there. And I think religion steps in when the emotions we can be overwhelmed by emotions, like in cases of grief or fear or anger.
Talking to Stephen Asma, professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago, talking about his new book, Why We Need Religion. So we've got this strong emotional grounding in our brains, in our evolution. Stephen, how does religion help us to manage extreme emotion in particular, grief, fear, anger?
Yeah. Grief, as we all know, can be very debilitating. I was lecturing a group on the East Coast, and afterwards a student came up to me and said that, and he was a young man, he was like, I don't know, 19 or 20, and he said that a few years before that, about 5 or 6 years before that, his own his family had suffered a terrible tragedy. His brother had actually been stabbed to death by a perpetrator who escaped and was never found. And this was a family of just three kids and a single mother raising them. And what happened was that as the student explained to me, his mother went into such a deep despair and depression, as you can imagine, that she became utterly debilitated by it and could not function. And it was only through a kind of what we would call magical thinking, religious imagination, and also the sort of rituals and practices of her religious community that slowly brought her back, got her on her feet, and helped her to restore her with the hope and the desire to see her murdered son again in the afterlife. Now, you know, a skeptic or one of these sort of new atheists might look at that and say, well, that's wishful thinking. But look at the power of that wishful thinking. She was able to then take care of the rest of her kids and get through life. And it in some sense is a kind of religion provides us with some of these reset buttons for handling and then getting back into the social world and surviving.
Yeah, that's seems to be a recurring theme in your book. It would be easy to argue there is an afterlife. There isn't an afterlife. This particular belief is right. This particular belief is wrong. You seem to be making the case, who cares? Let's see what it does for us in our daily lives.
Yeah, that's. I guess that's fairly controversial because we like to think, you know, we have some kind of responsibility to the truth. And ordinarily, I would say, yes, we do. But there's a range of beliefs where the evidence is not clear one way or the other. And in those cases, I follow sort of the American pragmatist philosopher William James, who said, live and let live. If it helps you to believe in this thing and it has palpable benefits to you, then there's no reason why you shouldn't. I think what the atheist and the skeptic is worried about is they're desperately afraid they're going to believe in something that turns out to be false. You know, they don't want to be duped. They don't want to end up looking like a boob somehow. But that's also a kind of emotional anxiety or fear. And William James said, you know, they're working from their own emotional palette, and they should be more charitable towards people with different beliefs.
We're talking to Stephen Asma, professor of philosophy and founding fellow of the research group in mind, science, and culture at Columbia College in Chicago. We're talking about his new book. It's called Why We Need Religion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself religious or spiritual? And does your religion help you to manage your emotions? Things like anger, fear, and grief. Does it provide you with a sense of community and support? If you do not consider yourself religious, do you do these things in other ways? Have you found other ways to deal with issues like grief in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up a conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation with Stephen Asma, professor of philosophy and founding fellow of the research group in mind, science, and culture at Columbia College Chicago. His new book is Why We Need Religion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find, if you're a person of faith, that your faith helps you deal with issues like grief and other strong emotional situations in your everyday life? Is that an important part of your religion, or is that just a side benefit of your belief? If you are not religious yourself, what do you think of our guest's argument? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to our callers now. David is with us in Clam Lake. David, hi.
Hey, hi. Hey, good afternoon. Stephen, I wanted to ask you, if across the ages of modern humans, do you think that there is a dynamic going on between, you know, this want of individuality in all of us and uniqueness compared to participation in community and you know, social things and the society benefits that religion brings? And in fact, there's also this idea that, well, I want to be my own person. I don't want to go along with a group. And is there a push-pull with this? And has that been a developmental feature of the human race?
David, thanks. Stephen, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've had some experience culturally, you know, cross-culturally myself, having lived in, obviously the U.S. For most of my life, but also spent time in China, and I even have a Chinese family. There in Asia, you know, the stereotype is sort of true that there's a little more emphasis on the community or the group rather than the individual. And the stereotype of the Westerner is that there's a more of a celebration of the individual. You know, just like some other stereotypes, there's some truth in this in my own experience. And you can see it in the religions. Buddhism, for example, very much celebrates the group rather than the individual. I would say that Western religions are more about individual salvation, although obviously compassion and help towards others is key to the virtues. But I think this is true in terms of the evolution of our species as well, that how do we come into the world? Do we come in as selfish individuals and then we have to learn through religion to share and cooperate with each other? Or there's a debate. Some other biologists say we come into the world already connected with others, like our mother, for example, through oxytocin and internal opioids and natural brain processes of bonding. And then slowly we emerge as individuals from this family unit. So I do think the caller's right, David's right. There's always been a sort of push and pull between stressing the individual and the community. And religion is really good at helping steer us toward the one we need at any given time. It sort of adapts to the times.
Thanks a lot for that call, David. You mentioned at the outset, Stephen, that there's two sides most vocal about issues of religion, the most devout and the most devoutly atheistic, if I can use that phrase. And it seems like they're not going to be neither side's going to be happy with what you're saying, because on the skeptic atheist side, they'll say, wait, you're telling me I have to pretend to be religious to get these benefits. On the devout side, saying, wait, I don't do this for the function. I actually believe in a set of very specific religious things here.
Right. No, that's true. And I think both those groups don't like my book, although many of them have not taken the time to see what the argument is, because just like in the political landscape, the people who get voice are the people on the extremes. The extreme right and the extreme left are oftentimes very vocal and they make good TV. And as a result of it, it gives one the impression that there's some, you know, that we're basically a battle of extreme positions. If you were living in Asia, for example, and looked at the news on Christianity, you'd see like a lot of coverage of the Westboro Baptist Church, which is, as many of the listeners know, is a very sort of a hate group, Christian hate group in Kansas. And there's only like 50 members of this church. And if that was your picture of Christianity, you'd have a very skewed and very strange view of it. I think that the vast majority of people are in this middle territory, and they have beliefs, but they also are not extreme or fanatical in them. They take them and they use them and they sort of adapt them. And this is the sort of group that I'm trying to speak for and speak to. And I think I've received a tremendous amount of good feedback from people since the book was published a couple of weeks ago.
I want to go back to our callers now. We have Kathy with us in Winthrop Harbor, Illinois. Kathy, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Good. Well, as I was waiting, just what your caller said, and forgive me, I've forgotten his name, but just what you said is exactly what I am, and you are speaking to me, and I will be getting your book, because at 56 going on 57, I find myself in quite a quandary as to, I don't know who I am, why I'm here, what do I, you know, and I was raised in a very, very structured religion most of my life, and I find it abhorrent. I find the word religion abhorrent, which is why I'm intrigued by you using the word religion, because to me, and it's my opinion, that is religion is a structured environment that is, it's black and white, it's all or nothing, and it's, to me, offensive, because in that religion I was in, I believed in that. You know, you follow what you're told to do, you do what you're supposed to do, and then find out that they're living a double life. The ones that are getting up on the pulpit of the stage are living a double life, oftentimes, or are very hypocritical. And I find that extremely offensive. I find myself being someone who is open to diversity, open to listening to other people's point of views, and, as you said, molding them to what fits for me, what feels right to me.
Kathy, thanks a lot for that call. And let's talk about that word religion. When you're talking about these emotional benefits of religion, Stephen, are you talking about religion as Kathy is describing it with that formalized structure? Or could it be a lot of people make that distinction between religion and a more individual spirituality, which I think is where Kathy was going there?
Yeah, I'm a, you know, a big fan of that movement, and I think many people are sort of fashioning their spiritual practices and beliefs outside of, you know, the constraints of what, you know, Kathy was pointing out is very hypocritical institutions of religion. However, the downside of that, I think, is that oftentimes, you know, I teach college students and I ask them, because they're the millennials coming up now, you know, and they're very spiritual, but they're against religion for all the reasons Kathy was talking about. And yet they, what they're doing is engaging in the magical thinking of spirituality. But what they lack is the sort of social connection that traditional religion has provided. Like, if you think about the religion of your parents and your grandparents, for all of its flaws, you still got together once or twice or maybe a few times a week, and you spent time singing together, religious festivals, shaking hands, even embracing. There's grieving customs, there's sacrifice, there's dance, there's, you know, all of the sort of practices. And what I think religion provides that spirituality lacks, at least in its current formulation, is this social bonding. And that social bonding is absolutely crucial for happiness. Lots of psychological studies are suggesting that the key ingredient in the happy life, the long happy life, is social connection. And we're living in a society where more and more people are going, you know, buying a spirituality app for their phone and sitting in their room and sort of meditating. Well, that's great, but also one needs that sort of social interaction that that traditional religion provides too.
Kathy, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Phyllis with us in Greenwood. Phyllis, hi.
Hi. Yes, my question is this. Early on, we started out spiritual, and if this is a process of evolution and we've become more rational, then can we assume that ultimately we will move towards greater rationality?
Interesting. That emotional side may be less important in evolution than our rational one over the long haul, Stephen.
Yeah, I think the traditional functions of religion would have included things like explaining nature. And we no longer need religion to tell us how the universe got here or how it works. Science has taken over that job quite well. And also, I don't think we need religion to tell us how to sort of be ethical with each other, because our rationality is also pretty good on that front. But I do think there are forms of suffering that happen to us, even in our scientific age, for which there is no scientific alleviation. You can lose your loved one. I mean, a parent loses a child. What in rationality, in the rational life or in the scientific life, is going to come to the rescue of such despair? It's not impossible. I mean, there are individuals that can rally back, and there's no doubt about that, and more power to you. But religion is a cultural system that helps you get through that and think about it in a way that makes it meaningful and gets you back in the game of life. And so in that sense, I think those aspects of religion are not going away.
Very briefly, Stephen, and it's a big question, can we get those things you're talking about in an organized way without a metaphysical belief?
I think we can, and that's one of the arguments I'm making in the book, is the metaphysical belief is helpful for sure, but engaging in the practices, the rituals, the life of religion gives you many of those emotional benefits, even if you don't share some of the magical thinking.
We'll leave it there, Stephen. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Stephen Asma. He's a professor of philosophy and founding fellow of the research group in mind, science, and culture at Columbia College in Chicago. He joined us to talk about his new book. It's called Why We Need Religion. You can still share your thoughts, your responses. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or you can always join the conversation on Twitter. Tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Let us know what your reaction is to our guest's argument. Baseball's All-Star Game is just over a week away. The Brewers will have a presence there, but will they have enough of a presence? Producer Bill Martins is in the studio. Bill, who is going to the game?
So it's outfielders Christian Yelich and Lorenzo Cain, who they just picked up in the offseason right before this year, and relief pitcher Josh Hader, who's been probably the best reliever in all of baseball this year.
Right. Those are three for sure going. But
right.
There's still wiggle room for a fourth, and a lot of people are making the case that there should be a fourth.
Right. Jesus Aguilar was someone who kind of came out of nowhere for the Brewers this year. He wasn't even a lock to
Cinderella story.
Exactly. He wasn't even a lock to make the team. But it wasn't until the regular first baseman, Eric Thames, got hurt that he came in and was able to start, you know, showing what he can do. And he's been putting up MVP-type numbers this year. And he wasn't even on the ballot for the All-Star game because he, you know, wasn't a starter for the beginning of the season, I guess. And so there's this push now from the Brewers to vote for Aguilar as one of the final what do they call it? Like
there's
final
still,
vote.
There's and, still room, yeah.
Right, the National League final vote. There's five guys you can vote for. Aguilar is one of them. So go online, vote for Aguilar. And they're also encouraging...
They're saying that. We can't encourage you to do that.
Correct. Fine.
Quoting.
They're also encouraging Brewer fans to vote for this guy, Eddie Rosario, for the Twins. And then the Minnesota fans are encouraging their fans to vote for Aguilar
so
to try to boost
trading.
Midwestern representation. Exactly.
Right. Well, we'll watch to see. They've got a Twitter hashtag real quick.
I think it's We Believe in Jesus.
All right. Thanks, Bill. This is Central Time.